on FM, online, and on TuneIn 24/7. This is 88.3 Southern FM.
Planet Earth, you're looking at planet Earth. Ba, 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 ba. This is planet Earth.
Welcome to episode 36 of our Planet Earth series, a series in which we look at our home planet. And first up, ISAT-2. Well, ISAT-2 is a satellite that was launched in 2018. The name is an acronym for Ice, Cloud, and Land Elevation Satellite. As its name suggests, it is a craft that measures our planet's ice and cloud cover. The satellite remains healthy and has collected science data for more than 12,000 orbits. Because its orbit repeats the same ground track every 91 days, it allows cyclical elevation change measurements to be made. Of key importance, the data has been used to calculate the changing mass of ice sheets in Antarctica and Greenland and to estimate sea ice thickness in the Arctic Ocean and also in the ocean surrounding Antarctica. These measurements are possible because ISAT-2 has a laser that shines down from the satellite, reflects off the ice, and is received back at the satellite. The system is so accurate, it can not only measure the thickness of floating sea ice, it can also show the depth of snow atop the ice. The initial results from ISAT-2 suggest that the sea ice has thinned by as much as 20% since the end of the first ISAT mission in 2009. The measurements are accurate to better than 3 centimetres. By the end of 2020, there had been 50 scientific papers published using ISAT-2 data, with many others in review.
Earth below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless.
Alex Gardner is a glaciologist at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and he gave a talk recently about what NASA scientists are doing to study ice and climate using ISAT-2 and another pair of satellites called the GRACE follow-on. Here's Alex Gardner.
Yeah, so NASA's doing all sorts of really amazing things. Maybe we could bring up the ISAT-2, and I'll talk about that satellite. So I'm just going to nerd out here for a bit. I am not a closet nerd. I am totally out of the closet. I am 100% nerd, and I love this stuff. And this is some of the coolest engineering that, you know, we can imagine. So this instrument that you're looking at here is called a laser altimeter. Now, it is no different than that thing you go by at the hardware store to tell you how far you are from one wall. You know, it shoots out the little infrared beam and you can measure the distance. Well, this is a much more sophisticated version of that. And so it has a laser. That laser goes out and it splits into 6 different beams when it goes through a special lens. And those 3 beams land on the Earth. And it releases trillions of photons with each shot. And it takes 10,000 shots per second. So it's operating incredibly fast. And each one of those shots lands on the surface of the Earth, and those trillions of photons scatter all over the place. And only 6 to 12 of those photons end up reaching the telescope back on the spacecraft. And it can time tag each individual photon. So the smallest quanti of energy, we can now measure it bouncing off the surface of the Earth. And we can make incredibly precise measurements of how the surface of the Earth is changing. So for an example, I'm in Los Angeles, and if you were standing on the sidewalk in San Diego, which is all the way down at the Mexican border, I could measure whether you stepped off the curb or not. That's how powerful this thing is. That instrument, what it allows us to do is it allows us to see the shape of the ice sheet as it responds. So we might see it growing, we might see it shrinking in response to either a warming ocean, changes in precipitation, or changes in warming from the atmosphere. And so it tells us a huge amount about what the ice sheets are doing in response to current changes in climate. And the other satellite I wanted to talk about, and this one's just as fascinating. This is a follow-on satellite, meaning we've done this once before. But I used to be a professor in Massachusetts, and I taught remote sensing, which is basically satellite observations. And the start of all of those textbooks says, you know, satellites measure some spectrum of the electromagnetic spectrum. And that was true until we put up GRACE. So GRACE is actually measuring changes in the Earth's gravity. And so, you know, you probably learned in school that gravity is 9.14 meters per second squared. Well, it actually has slight variations everywhere on Earth. And where there's more mass, like a large mountain, you know, the gravitational pull is ever so slightly higher. And so these satellites orbit the Earth, and as they do, they very precisely measure the distance between themselves, down to the fraction of the thickness of a human hair in distance between those satellites. And it goes around and it repeats these measurements. And so we can actually see where the gravity is stronger and where the gravity is weaker. But even more amazing is it can see the changes over time. And so when it rains in California, we can see California get heavier because there's all this water sitting on the surface. But the biggest changes that we see are the ice sheets. The ice sheets are rapidly losing mass into the oceans. And so we can see that in incredible detail on a monthly resolution. So we can actually see these things gain mass in the winter and then lose a whole lot of ice in the summer. And it's fascinating. The engineering that's being done, I don't think is imaginable even 20 years ago.
On the Space Show, our topic is the iSat-2 satellite. And our guest is Alex Gardner, a glaciologist at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
Planet Earth is blue.
And Alex has been studying ice in the past as well as in the present.
The world has been covered by large amounts of ice in the past that have waxed and waned. So much so that when it was about 4 degrees colder in North America, we had what was called the Laurentide Ice Sheet 20,000 years ago. And that ice sheet was so massive that it came all the way down and covered Boston and Chicago with about a mile of ice. And it created Cape Cod. And then as the climate warmed, that ice mass retreated. And that actually created a land bridge at the time because sea levels had dropped so much because there was so much land on ice. And people were able to move across the land bridge from Asia into North America. And it impacted the climate. It impacted the sea levels. And it even impacts the rotation of the Earth. So believe it or not, when you have more ice caps, there's more ice at the poles. You put more mass at the poles, which actually causes the Earth to spin a little faster. And when you lose that ice, it actually goes, kind of sloshes down towards the equator. And it's kind of like a ballerina putting her arms out when she's spinning. If she puts her arms out to slow down. And so as the ice melts, it actually slows the rotation of the planet. It's shaped a lot of the landscapes that we see. It's responsible for all sorts of really interesting things. And it's one of the most vulnerable to a changing climate. And that's because ice on Earth resides very close to 0 degrees Celsius. So right near the melting point. So you turn up the thermostat just a little bit and a lot of things change. Not only that, but they've got these amazing, what we call feedbacks, where if you push it a lot, it starts to run away. And it has some of the largest feedbacks in the Earth system. And they're fascinating as a researcher to study and highly important in terms of what the societal consequences of those things mean.
And the question is, well, are the ice sheets gaining? How do they gain mass and how do they lose mass? Alex Gardner has this comment.
So the ice sheets are always gaining mass and always losing mass. So since the dawn of time, an ice sheet has always had snow falling on it and it's always had water running off into the ocean. And when the climate is in equilibrium, there's always as much coming in as there is going out. And so the geometry of the ice sheet stays the same. And so it's this amazing thing where the ice sheet's always in balance. It's always putting ice into the ocean. and it's always getting snow from accumulation. But as you turn up the thermostat, you start to move things out of equilibrium, and two things happen. So first of all, you get what you would normally expect, and that is that the water runs off into the ocean. So you melt the surface melts, and all that water runs off to the ocean. But the thing we think about a little bit less is the ice is moving. It's dynamic. And when we talk about future sea level rise and future sea level rise uncertainty, it's this part that we're interested in, this part that we're most concerned about, because that ice can start to slip. And so I just say one more thing, and that is that when we see the ice sheets change, when the topography or the elevation, or when we start to see changes, what that tells us is that the climate that they exist in is no longer in balance with them. And so the ice sheets have to respond. They have no choice. And so this is where NASA comes in and brings in a large suite of tools.
At this talk, at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, there was an opportunity to ask questions. Here's his response to one of those.
What does this mean as far as being helpful? How can this data help?
So that's a great question. And it's one I struggle with myself. This data is incredibly helpful. It tells us what the Earth system is doing. It tells us all of the complexities about how all of these different parts interact. When you raise CO2, you warm the ocean. When you warm the ocean, you increase the melting of ice around the Antarctic. When you increase the melting of ice around the Antarctic, you cause less ice to resist the flow of ice into the ocean. And so you actually see the ice speed up. And then when you see the ice speed up, you actually see the gravity change. And when the gravity changes, you can see the ice going into the ocean, and then you can see the sea levels rise. And then you can see where the sea levels are rising as the gravity redistributes that ice around the world. It's these observations from space that are the only way we can see the Earth as a complete system, right? It is really a self-contained small ecosystem, a marble in space, and the only way we can understand all of the interconnectivity is through these satellite observations. But I preface that with I struggle. And the reason I struggle is because it's only useful if we can take the science and we can learn from it. And the science has clearly shown over the last two decades that the ice is incredibly sensitive to changes in temperature, and it is responding now. And we know that it's going to keep increasing sea levels into the future. And we know a bunch of other things that are going to change in the climate system, most of which, the vast majority of which are going to be negative for most societies. There are some countries that will benefit in the short term. So places like Canada will have increased agricultural productivity. That's a benefit to them, but they'll also have to deal with the increased stresses of other countries having less. And so increased global food insecurity is going to be one of the biggest future consequences. And so the data is really only useful if we use it. If we listen to the scientists that interpret the data, we listen to the modelers that project the future, and then we take that information and we start to think deeply as a society, what are the decisions that we would like to make to include the information that we get from this incredible sensor array that we have in space?
Is there a relationship between ice and extreme weather? And how will extreme climate affect the future?
Wow, that is a great question. And yes, there are very strong links. There is an interesting thing that they believe happened in the past, and that is that there was so much water that poured off of the Laurentide ice sheet that it actually put a freshwater cap in the North Atlantic. And that freshwater cap prevented what we call the thermal haline circulation, which is how the oceans move, how the oceans circulate water. And at the time, it actually prevented it, and it caused a very cold Europe. And people are studying this in a lot of detail. And there is a real risk that that could happen. I think the risk of it happening is unlikely, but there is a risk that it could happen. But most of the extreme comes from changes in precipitation. So we have a stronger gradient between the polar regions and the lower latitudes, and that drives a much more vigorous climate. And so that's where we expect a lot of the extreme drought and extreme precipitation to come from.
Earth below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless.
88.3 Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
This is planet Earth. You're looking at planet Earth. Ba, 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 ba. This is planet Earth. Earth.
On the space show, we're looking at the ISAT satellite, but before we return to Alex Gardner, the glaciologist, let's hear a song by Leslie Fish. It's called Ship of Stone. Yes, Ship of Stone. Well, this views the planet Earth as a spaceship of stone. And according to Leslie, no matter how far we travel among the stars, we will always look back to Earth. And this will be true even if we evolve into different beings from today's humans. This song was written by Don Simpson in 1981.
Once there was a ship of stone that orbited a mighty star. And from it flew the first ship's crew, whose children we all are. And no matter how long we've drawn our track, still over our shoulder looking back, through the hydrogen's hiss and the methane's moan, past the polymer clouds of the dead star shrouds, all our roads run back to the ship of stone. There the first crew all were made and wakened from unknowing sleep by the boundless sight of heaven's height and the fires of the deep. And no matter how strange the forms we wear, how warped and wild, how rich and rare, how changed we've made the seed we've sown. We are blood of those who, singing, rose from the body of the ship of stone. And there our own ship's frames were formed to grow blue glowing wings and spread them wide to the farthest tide, where the last lone beacon sings. And no matter how tight the net they knot of our web, where the wheel of light is caught, how strange and lost, how grand they've grown. They too desire all heaven's fire, our comrades since the ship of stone. Once there was a ship of stone, clear of domed, broad-hulled and clean, where the air shone blue, through whose holds birds flew, and whose decks were growing green. And no matter how odd these things may seem, as madly mazed as shards of dream, they are not a dream that you dream alone. Men are of one kin. We shall not forget the ship of stone.
On this evening's Space Show, we're looking at the ice covering of Leslie Fish's Ship of Stone. We now return to the talk by Alex Gardner, the glaciologist at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and he has some temperature rise predictions.
if we really got our act together as a people on this planet, and we were able to stop or to have peak emissions by 2040, we would have a 3 degrees Fahrenheit rise in temperature. If we have peak emissions in 2060, which is still considered overly ambitious at this point, considering the progress that we've been able to make so far, we would have a 4 degrees rise in temperature. And if we just kind of operate like we're operating right now, and since this study came out in 2005, all indications report that we are on this higher track. It is the best prediction of what track we're on right now. And this is what we call the business as usual. So if we start to account for improvements in technology that will slowly bring down the emissions, you know, improvements in fuel economy, if we assume that the poor countries will want to have lifestyles more similar to developed Western nations, first world nations, you know, if we account for these things, and then we also account for the plateauing of population growth, as we expect that population growth will peak during this century. This is where we'll be at. And again, that small figure at the bottom, that is the variability over the last 800,000 years. And what I'm showing to scale is the different scenarios of where we're headed. And so when I do the science I'm doing, I'm only studying the very bottom part of that graph. And when we look at the models to tell us what does it mean when we look at these future scenarios, they tell us that there's a lot of negative consequences coming down the pipeline. They tell us that the ice is going to continue to melt. That's a guarantee. And they tell us that the wetter regions of Earth will likely get wetter. The drier regions of Earth will likely get drier. The frequency of storms and droughts will increase. And then there's some other impacts as well. Rising oceans will start to cause problems for coastal communities where we've built a lot of our infrastructure. And so I don't want to be a complete doomsday person. I mean, there are things we can do to mitigate this. And the best thing that we can do to mitigate this is really to focus on the emissions. And so really, we're going to have to stop emitting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. And whatever we can do to get towards that path is positive. But whatever it is, it's going to have to be collective action. And so we're far beyond the point now of being able to do individual action to have a meaningful impact on this situation. It is very serious, and it is something that we need to tackle starting now. And we're also going to have to think about mitigation now. We're not just talking about avoiding any harm. Some harm is already going to happen. We already have enough CO2 in the atmosphere that we're going to have to think about mitigation. And so that is, you know, thinking about our coastal infrastructure and which infrastructure we would like to shore up and defend against a rising ocean, which infrastructure it probably isn't cost effective to do that. And what that means is that we have to spend taxpayer dollars on mitigating this. And the most effective use of taxpayer dollars is really to prevent it from going in the atmosphere in the first place. Because once you start trying to kind of mitigating all the compounding consequences afterwards, it gets really expensive. And I'm sure we would rather spend our tax dollars on healthcare or any of the other number of things, or just keep it in our pockets than spending it on mitigating the damage we've done. Yeah. So I listened to a very prominent scientist this morning, and he said, let's be the generation that rose to the challenge, not the generation that failed to rise to the challenge. I started my career in glaciology in 2005. And there wasn't a lot happening to the ice then. And usually when we would think of glaciers, we would think of glaciers as responding really slow to something. And we used to say it happened at glacier timescales, which meant it happened really slowly. And even 10, 15, 20 years ago, people kind of thought that it would take a while for the ice sheets to respond once the climate changed. But what we started to learn is there were some processes that we didn't understand fully, and the ice sheets are responding really fast. And so just over this short period, we've seen really rapid changes in the ice sheet. We see the Greenland wasting away, putting almost 250 cubic kilometers of water into the ocean every year, causing measurable amounts of change in sea levels. And the glaciers, every glacier region on Earth is losing mass. So are losing mass. So it's losing ice into the ocean. So Alaska, Patagonia, high mountain Asia, the Alps, New Zealand, all of the Arctic islands, everywhere there's ice, it's all being wasted away, which tells us that the ice is out of equilibrium with the climate.
Alex Gardner finished his talk at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory by describing what satellites have revealed about ice sheet changes.
Let me just start with the satellites, and then I'm going to put the satellites into a bit of a broader perspective. So the satellites have really revealed a lot of things. They've revealed some concerning things in the Antarctic. There's very vulnerable places in the Antarctic. Specifically, it's Pine Island and Thwaites Glaciers. There's these two larger than you can imagine streams of ice that pour ice from the interior of the ice sheets into the ocean. And those two systems are particularly vulnerable to what we call the marine ice sheet instability. And that is where you start melting, you start putting the ice flows faster, it puts more ice into the ocean, that causes it to melt faster. And there's this feedback loop, and you can get these runaway effects where the ice sheet collapses. And we don't know if that's happening. There's some speculation that it is happening. And I don't even know if we have a consensus on that, but the satellites reveal that it is changing now. And so it's an area that we're looking at a lot. It's revealed that the East Antarctic is gaining a little bit of mass. And then it's also revealed that since about 2000, the Greenland ice sheet has been rapidly losing mass as we've had much warmer Arctic summers. But, you know, we've unfortunately only had a really short record from space. And so there have been people with boots on the ground that have been taking all sorts of measurements. And probably one of the most valuable measurements that we have is ice cores. And so this is where they take a drilling rig and they bring it to the ice sheet. And it's a huge, huge operation. And they spend years drilling these long cores of ice, and trapped within the ice are tiny little bubbles that were actually trapped from the atmosphere all the way up to a million years ago. And so you can take that ice and you can bring it, seal it up and bring it back to a lab, and you can actually extract the air that's in those bubbles. And so we can see what the past concentration of greenhouse gases was in the atmosphere in incredible detail for the last million years. So here's a record from one of the ice cores, and it goes back almost a million years. So I'm showing 800,000 years. And to put that into perspective of how long that is, I've marked on this figure where the birth of modern man was about 200,000 years ago. So modern man has existed for a climate that's kind of been within these wiggles ever since modern man was on Earth. And it's just incredible the information we can get. So the red one that we see, that is a proxy for temperature. It's a fraction between delta 018 and 016. But what it tells us is it tells us how much energy or what the temperature was of the atmosphere all the way to 800,000 years ago. And then the other thing we can measure directly is the amount of CO2 contained in those air samples. And as you can see in this figure, you know, as the CO2 goes up, so does the temperature. And when the CO2 goes down, so does the temperature. And so they follow each other incredibly well. And there's all these complex feedbacks that we understand that are, you know, very difficult to... Anyway, there's a lot of processes involved, but the only thing that matters is that, you know, the temperature of the planet is incredibly closely tied to the amount of greenhouse gases, and in this case, CO2 in the atmosphere.
Speaking at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory earlier this year, that was Alex Gardner, a glaciologist who actually works at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Well, the theme of tonight is ice, the cryosphere. It's called the ice cover, and the satellite called ICESat-2. And this report from the Goddard Space Flight Center says that ICESat-2 has discovered new lakes under the Antarctic ice sheet.
Below thousands of meters of ice in Antarctica lie hundreds of meltwater lakes where the Antarctic ice sheet meets the continent's bedrock. Until pretty recently, we thought that these lakes sat quietly, isolated in pockets under the ice. But in 2007, laser measurements of the ice surface from NASA's ICESat satellite were used to infer what was happening far below. And a much more interesting picture was revealed. By watching local areas of the surface of the massive ice sheet rise and fall due to fluctuations in the lake water levels below, we learn that vast hydrologic systems like rivers connect many of these lakes, and that some actively fill and drain all the time. Thanks to the more advanced laser technology on NASA's ICESat-2 satellite, in a region very near a pair of larger lakes measured in 2007, two more of these lakes have just been found. A new study shows that they are currently experiencing a draining period. The finding also gives us the most detailed picture yet of how the boundaries of lakes can change over time. Areas seen here in blue show that the surface of the ice is getting lower, which indicates that the lakes below are draining. Understanding how much water is flowing under the ice sheet and how quickly it can drain to the sea helps give us a better picture of not only how quickly the Antarctic ice sheet will change due to a warming climate, but also how Antarctic melt will affect both global ocean currents and sea level rise.
This is Planet Earth. You're looking at Planet Earth.
We'll finish our Planet Earth episode tonight with Jack Cooper and a poem about climate change.
Hi, I'm Jack Cooper. I'm 23 and I'm in Coventry. I've written about climate change before the Freud Climate Crisis Challenge, but it's always been impersonal. It's been a landscape poem on drowned London, whereas for this challenge I really wanted to dig into my own perspective. Which is when I'm faced with a global overwhelming crisis like COVID or climate change, I find it comforting to really bury in on the fact that ultimately my life doesn't matter and I'm completely insignificant. And how I've done this in the past is there's this particular YouTube video where you start off with an image of the Earth and then you pull out to bigger and bigger planets, bigger and bigger stars until you truly see the scale of the universe and how small you are in it. And I find that comforting. I don't know why, but that's for the people at the Freud Museum conference to work out. Earth, you are here. After Morn 1415's YouTube video, Star Size Comparison 1 HD. The sun swallows Earth in 7.5 billion years. And life is 3.5 billion years old, which, relatively speaking, means both myself and all life on Earth is at a quarter-life crisis. Katy Perry was right. I feel like a plastic bag drifting through the wind and, oh God, am I meant to be worried about the wind as well? Look, the universe is a lot. When I want to feel insignificant, I think of the star that would take a jet more than 1,000 years to orbit, that the sun, our own star, would burst on, like a Coke bottle dropped on asphalt. Our planet is a postcard held in the beak of a horrible goose, and I don't like what's written on it. But Earth, you are still here. You are still here.
This is Planet Earth. You're looking at Planet Earth. Ba, 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 ba. This is Planet Earth.